the method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to episode 25 of Unsound Methods with me, Lachlan Bloom.
And me, Jamie Batchen. So, a quarter of a century of episodes. Thank you for listening. If this is your first time, Unsound Methods is a podcast where we speak to other writers of literary fiction about their craft, technique, motivation. And if you've been with us the whole way through, thanks for sticking with us.
So this time we spoke to Tony White, had a great conversation about his process.
We all had colds recording this as well. So there is a bit of coughing, a little bit more graveliness than we normally aspire to. Ladies and gentlemen, Tony White.
Yes.
Well, thank you for coming in to join us.
Thank you for inviting me, yes.
We could talk about what are you writing at the moment? What stage are you at? And how does that relate to your process?
I am writing the second part of the series of novels that began with The Fountain in the Forest, which just came out in paperback this year. And the whole project is a kind of 90-chapter entity, the first 30 chapters formed The Fountain in the Forest, and I'm just coming to the end of part two now, actually. Just been sort of working on that for a couple of years. And yes, what to say about the process? There's quite a lot to say about the process.
Okay, but I guess, yeah, we were sort of starting off by just focusing on, like, specifically this week. You're getting towards the end of, say, a first draft.
Yes, getting towards the end of a first draft, and that means really, at the moment, I'm working every day, except for Fridays when I'm doing a bit of teaching. And I get up at 5:30, 5:45, make a strong coffee, and start work as soon as I can. And sort of work through till late morning, take a little break, carry on, If it's not too long before, I think in the next week or so, I'm going to hit that point where I need to be working all the time just to kind of get through the last 10%. But that my routine is pretty much get up 5:45, 5:45 and start at 6.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you've got quite a clear sort of overview of the sort of percentage of the book, how much you've completed so far. Is that the same with every project?
This one's very strange because The Fountain in the Forest and this as yet untitled second part are very much about the measurement of time, you know, and they are the reason that the whole thing is 90 chapters long is because it's mapped against a 90-day period in 1985, the 90 days between the end of the miners' strike and the Battle of the Beanfield, when there was a sort of huge police ambush that prevented the Stonehenge Free Festival from happening that year and forevermore. And the novels look at that period through the French Revolutionary calendar, first of all, and through that lens of 10-day weeks, 90 days becomes 9 revolutionary weeks. And each portion of the novel has been 30 days or mapped against a 30-day period, so 30 chapters. Mm. So it's kind of it's fairly regulated.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds very, yeah, very constrained.
And it's written with a mandated vocabulary and that kind of dual kind of mesh. I'm pretty close to knowing that I've got 10% left to write.
And at what point did that come to you, that structure? Did you know that before sort of starting the first chapter of the first book that this was the structure you were fitting everything
well,
around?
Well, this novel, well, The Fountain in the Forest and the one that I'm writing now are very different to any novel that I've written before, in that I'd been trying to write something like The Fountain in the Forest for about at least a decade, or sort of researching the novel and looking for a way into that period, but a way not to kind of have to just plod through it for a more sort of radical approach.
You see the period, the 80s or the French...
The period in the 1980s, yeah. Which is kind of transformational time in British politics. And it's kind of, you know, maybe as a kind of a revolution in policing that happened in the immediate aftermath of the miners' strike, when all of the lessons that had been learnt against the miners were then turned on other sections of the civilian population. So I've been trying to reach that period for a long time and sort of researching the novel. And actually, another aspect of my process that kind of fed into that is to do with collaboration. I've been kind of thinking through this and sort of telling myself parts of the story, kind of trying to work through it in my head to work out how I could make certain things kind of happen within the novel. And then I had an opportunity to do a collaboration with the artists Jane and Louise Wilson, which was a commission to mark the then 25th anniversary of the Chernobyl disaster in 1986. And I thought, this is a great opportunity to get quite close to 1985, you know, a close pass. So I kind of grabbed that commission, that collaboration. And because it was to do with Chernobyl, Jane and Louise were off in Prepiat taking this incredible series of photographs, which became a touring exhibition. And I was invited to join them and to make that the kind of somehow the subject of a piece of fiction. But I thought, actually, if they're doing that, I don't need to do that. You know, I don't just want to go and follow them around. I'm much more interested in how that disaster played out in words, you know, and how it played out in words at the time. And so I was looking for a kind of control that could sort of balance what they were doing, this new stuff that they were generating. And I was doing a lot of research in the archives of Leeds Other Paper up in Leeds Central Library, and because it was one of the few sources of factual information about the dangers of the radiation that was coming over from Chernobyl. And also working through the Guardian archives of the time. And maybe I was just getting a bit bored of reading, you know, these kind of microfiches. And I remembered that I used to do the Guardian crossword in the 1980s. I used to buy the Guardian every day because it was 10p or 20p or something like that, and do the crossword, you know, from about 1984 till about 86. That's what I'd do every day. And I just sort of, when I was researching this piece of fiction with Jane and Louise, I just thought, actually, I'm a bit bored. Maybe I'll just do one of those crosswords again that I did before, you know, 30 odd years ago. And thinking it'd be a way of just re-immersing myself in the habits of the time or something like that. But in fact, I wasn't prepared for this huge kind of Proustian rush of memories and associations that came from performing this thing again, you know, doing this crossword and remembering, you know, Perec's crosswords in his sort of later life. Just, you know, a connection was made. Maybe these crossword solutions could become could be used as a mandated vocabulary. If I was going to write about, as I did in the end, the sort of 12 days between the Chernobyl disaster happening and the first relatively open press conference that the Politburo held about it, 12 days. Mm. And the sort of paucity of information that was available between, you know, in that period, compared with what happened during Fukushima, you know, terabytes of data streaming in real time. We watched the tidal waves coming in and hitting the nuclear power station. Whereas at Chernobyl, it took 12 days for for almost any information to kind of be to be released. And I mean, as a novelist, that's an absolute gift. You've got a sort of limited amount of information, a defined period, kind of huge cataclysmic event. And here, a mandated vocabulary, a way of writing about it, which seemed to unlock something about the unconscious of the period. So that turned into a novella called Dicky Starr and the Garden Rule, which was published alongside Jane and Louise's exhibition. And it became a sort of test piece for The Fountain in the Forest. So that was one, you know, part of the approach nailed down.
And then, that set in the USSR, or was that set?
It's set in Leeds.
Okay, so it was the sort of
reaction
here. I was just thinking about how, with that mandated vocabulary, it seems quite tricky in The Fountain in the Forest.
Yeah.
If you were then basing it in the USSR and having to get some of those words in.
No. I was really interested just in how the information kind of came through here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, in the UK. And because of Leeds' other paper, I just thought it would be good to set it in Leeds. Mm-hmm. And then another collaboration was with the artist Stuart Brisley, British performance artist, very kind of radical performance artist, who approached me because he had been making performance art, these kind of 10-day performances of, you know, that somehow referenced the French Republican calendar and its 10-week structure. And he approached me and said, you know, I've been doing this work since the early 70s. Nobody's really noticed it. Shall we talk about that, you know? And so we cooked up a kind of collaboration, which through a series of conversations, where to talk about his approach to the Republican calendar. And that had its own outputs of, in terms of readings and performances and publications. But at the end of this series of 10 conversations, I was left with this this idea of his, which had been really to use the Republican calendar as a structure within which a kind of revolutionary performance could happen. I thought, that's quite interesting. If I apply that to this kind of 90-day period, it becomes, you know, as I was saying, 10 or 9 revolutionary weeks. And that the collision of those two things and the the novel
sounds
started.
Like quite an extensive research process before you sort of arrived
at absolutely that absolutely and not every project is like that. Some novels, you know, may come about because a short story can't be contained and just has to, you know, keep growing.
I mean, do you typically do a lot of research though before putting pen to paper? Describe that moment when the two ideas came together. Mm. I presume then you kind of had a concept of this being something bigger, a novel perhaps. Is there normally a moment that you kind of think, oh, this is going to be
I think there's often a moment where that generates enough kind of velocity and force to kind of push me through the
and does that normally follow research in that topic, or could it just be completely arbitrary sitting on a bus and an idea?
No, it usually follows lots of research, you know, and I mean, in this case, 10 years of research. But the strange thing about the mandated vocabulary and the, you know, the crossword solutions was that it sort of, because these were words that I'd actually written out before, you know, 30 years ago, it felt like the novel was somehow sort of predestined. You know, it still has that. There's a sort of uncanny kind of feeling when one's writing and the word, you know, the very word that you need, you know, in this chapter is in the crossword, you know.
Yeah. You didn't plan, as you completed the crossword, you didn't sort of think, oh, that's going to be in this place or that place.
No.
As you're writing, it's...
I did all 90 crosswords first. That was how I sort of started, sort of spent a couple of weeks. That may have been when I had the flu, you know, that I was talking about. I spent a couple of weeks in bed, you know, just doing these crosswords, 90 crosswords. but I didn't do any, I wasn't thinking, oh, that word needs to go there, or I was just sort of taking it as it kind of comes, and really taking, you know, being inspired by Calvino and the Castle of Cross Destinies, and, you know, the idea of I don't mean this in a kind of any sort of supernatural sense, but a kind of, there's a slightly divinatory kind of thing going on somehow, I think.
Yeah, and when you have that sort of sense, how does that translate into your sort of writing process? It sort of describes your process in this sort of latter end of the process, as you're nearing the end of you get out from work. This period at the start, is it a different process? Are you working in a different way at all?
The start is kind of, you know, starting that kind of morning routine. You know, once I know, once I'm kind of getting up at 6:15 and kind of trying to get through as much of a chapter as I can in a few days or a week or whatever, then I know that it's then I know it's serious. This is, you know.
And do you write anything down? I mean, obviously, I imagine you have quite a amount of notes by the time you come to write that. But do you write anything in terms of sort of plot or chapter breakdowns or anything like that before starting?
No. I have done in the past with my first novel, I probably wrote down what I thought might happen in the first 6 chapters and then kind of added to it as it went along. With Foxy T, my other Faber novel from 2003, I had something like a tube map. It looked like a map of the central line, with, you know, characters going along, you know, left to right, someone joining them, a little loop at the end. That was enough to kind of to organize that novel, which was very much a novel about a voice and place that wasn't broken into chapters. Mm-hmm. With The Fountain in the Forest and the current work in progress, I have a large grid pinned above my desk, which has it's just a way of kind of just externalizing some kind of idea of what the shape of the thing might be.
So what do you put on that grid?
Grid, all I've got in the date in 1985, the date in the Republican calendar, all of the crossword solutions, kind of key story points once I've got out of the chapter and onto the next one. And then lots of post-it notes. If I suddenly think, oh, gosh, you know, X needs to be somewhere here, I'll stick a post-it note on and gradually incorporate or cross off all of the post-it notes. And then the whole thing ends up populated with a kind of, chapter breakdown. Because these novels really kind of move backwards and forwards in time. Not only between the 1980s and now, but in The Fountain in the Forest, back as far as the collapse of the Italian occupation of Nice. I developed some kind of really rudimentary color coding to help me kind of keep track of that. And in fact, that I've had to produce a different another kind of diagram for part two that allows me to go a little deeper into the temporal stuff.
Yeah. And are there, with the characters, is there a continuation through the novels, or are they sort of
So The Fountain in the Forest functions partly as a kind of detective novel. There is a detective, Detective Sergeant Rex King of, you know, Holborn Police Station, who, I realized, if I was going to look at the, what was happening in policing in that period immediately after the miners' strike, that aftermath of the miners' strike and its legacy now, it would be useful to have someone on the inside to kind of explore that. Rex King is still a kind of very much a presence in part two. And so, a lot of the characters in part one don't make it out of the novel, to be honest. So.
And in terms of genre and stuff, does it does it change and sort of geography? I'm just sort of interested in, because you're doing something quite metafictional with it as well.
Yes.
Yeah, because you mentioned that it ends up in Nice as well, and obviously there's south of France, just down the line from Nice in the Fountain of the Forest.
Yeah. Place was a really important part of the researching of the book in a way. So that there's a kind of mirroring in a sense of place. The title, The Fountain in the Forest, is a kind of translation of the name of a fictional village in the south of France. I've added an extra mountain and an extra village between Nice and Grasse.
Yeah, it is fiction. I was going to look it up. We had a holiday down there a few years ago, and we sort of went from, I guess, Antibes up to Grasse.
Yes.
And I was thinking, like, I need to go on Google Maps. And normally I would pause reading to do it, and I haven't got around to it this time. So, okay.
Yeah, La Fontaine en Forêt is a fictional place.
Okay.
But it borrows the naming conventions of the area and also the historical and geographical kind of imperatives behind a lot of the settlements in that part of South France, which tend to be sort of hilltop settlements, which are roughly based around a defendable water source of some sort. And so the Fountain in the Forest was a way of directly, opening that up, I suppose. And a way of writing about some of the kind of, more hidden histories of some of the villages in that area without worrying about whether I was going to offend anyone. I could just put it all into a fictional village. But also the standing stone, there's a standing stone at the gate of the village of La Fontaine en Forêt, and that is real. So that there is a kind of ancient path up to this standing stone. There's just no little abandoned village being squatted by kind of bohemians in 1985. That bit didn't happen. The kind of mirror of that is Holborn Police Station on Lamb's Conduit Street. Lamb's Conduit, being named after William Lamb, who created a conduit that he dammed the Fleet River and put in some pipes to take a supply of fresh water into the city to Snow Hill. And so there's a kind of, slight symmetry there between the two.
When you're researching these sort of facts, do you, in terms of your process, you get down, sit in front of the desk to write, do you pause to, if you have a question about French village life or, it's something you're writing about, would you write in one continuous segment and then research later in the day and edit later on? Or do you kind of pause and check?
I mean, I sort of did all the research first in a way, not necessarily knowing that it would be used. There's a kind of, it's not a MacGuffin, but there's a kind of an Art Deco prototype electrical bread oven that plays a kind of fairly big part in the novel. And that's based on a real oven, that I've seen in a tiny little kind of wooden hovel in up the mountains there in the south of France. But it's also, it was also based on a real story from another part of France about a baker who doused his fire, abandoned his bake house when the Nazis were kind of 20 kilometers away because he, refused to feed Nazis and then just disappeared. And this abandoned bakehouse was only kind of opened up for the first time about 20 years ago. So somehow those two ideas got kind of fused. So when I started sort of thinking about that as maybe something that could propel a novel.
do remember to like,
and is there any kind of additional research you do as you're going along?
In this case, it's very, very interesting. The chapter that deals with that oven, I did have to kind of do some research into, you know, just when I knew that chapter was coming up, because I could sort of see the word oven, you know, in the crossword solutions or whatever it was, you know, bake or something. Yeah. So I knew it was going to have to be there in chapter 20. And so I did quite a lot of reading around what Nice looked like, you know, when around the time of the collapse of the Italian occupation.
And would you do that at a different time of day from the writing period? Do you have a sort of set writing period where you have no distractions and write without looking at internet?
I might have done it between chapters or something like that, probably. Yeah. Particularly working with the mandated vocabulary, there's a real imperative, as well as the sort of just the kind of the velocity and the pace of whatever else is happening in the chapter and the story. There's this kind of additional velocity that comes from, you know, trying to use all of the solutions as economically as possible. And so if I do need to break out, it tends to be once I've got to the end of that kind of that chapter, there's a sort of, it's hard to break out of the writing when you're in the middle of that kind of puzzle in a way.
But do you find it easy to compartmentalize then in terms of, right, once you've finished writing for the day?
I do actually. And this comes, we were talking about having young children just before we started recording. And my first novel I wrote, I'd been writing for maybe a decade before that, writing kind of short pieces. And my first novel, I was able to only really able to start it when my 2 or 3 year old son got a nursery place, and every weekday morning between 9 and 12, he was somewhere else, and I wasn't having to kind of micromanage and kind of look after every aspect of his life for 3 hours, or for, you know, for about 2 hours really by the time I got back home. And so the first novel was written in that 2 hours, you know, just over the space of a couple of weeks, really. So I think you learn techniques for compartmentalizing and sort of making the best use of what time you've got.
And does that apply to the grid and the post-it? Like, are you writing post-it notes sort of in the evening for
post-it notes whenever something occurs?
Yeah,
that has to be kind of written down and put onto the.
So you might be on the tube or something and just write down a quick note for later. And then
those will get kind of crossed off as they're kind of dealt with or incorporated as well.
You've written six novels now.
Six novels, yes.
Novellas.
Yes.
Of nonfiction. From that first novel that you were writing in sort of the 2 hour windows that you got, how has your process sort of changed? Did you sit down and write a lot of notes initially and you've gently weaned your way off that, or is it very similar how you still prepare?
No, it's completely different. I mean, and in fact, there's one kind of similarity, which is that first novel was written according to some kind of rules. I mean, but the rules were do no research whatsoever, write a chapter a day, you know, and it was trying to tap into that kind of pulp sensibility, I guess. This was in the mid 1990s, and there was a kind of quite an interesting conversation going on in literature at the time, or in the margins of literature and fiction in London, certainly, with people like authors like Victor Headley, Stuart Holme, Nicholas Blinko, Stella Duffy, and people who were kind of working with approaches and styles that were more associated with kind of popular kind of pulp fiction of the 60s and 70s, with New World science fiction, as well as the kind of skinhead novels of Richard Allen. And that seemed to be an interesting conversation that was going on in the East End of London. I lived in Hackney at the time, and Victor Headley and Dot and Adebayo set up Express in order to kind of publish new black fiction, and they were kind of selling copies of Yardie out of the boot of their car or through newsagents and things. And this was kind of very inspiring moment. So my first novel, which is called Road Rage, was written as a sort of part of that conversation, I suppose.
So you're sort of tapping into what was going on around. So
yeah.
You set out with a particular idea about the style of what you wanted to write for that, or was that just what you were into anyway and what you were kind of...
No, I set out with, with a very specific idea that I wanted to write something that was a, that would read like a sort of updated New English Library 16 chapter shocker, and I think I even modeled the opening chapter on the opening chapter of one of those novels, just the kind of shape of it.
Is that something that's common with all your projects, having an idea of the tone or the style that you want?
It's difficult. I mean, so my third novel, Charlie Uncle Norfolk Tango, was a sort of stream of sentience, kind of stream of filth, really. I mean, it's just this kind of foul-mouthed, policeman justifying his existence, really. And that was really written in disgust, I suppose, at the kind of dissembling that was going on around the murder of Stephen Lawrence and the investigation of that. And the way that you'd sort of see police spokesmen on the TV almost getting off on the kind of fatuousness of what they were saying, in a way that you sort of see when Ian Duncan Smith talks about sanctions or the universal credit or something. There's a kind of twinkle in the eye, and you can see he's enjoying it. And that was the catalyst for writing Charlie Uncle Norfolk Tango in that just that pre-McPherson report kind of moment.
So it sounds like the tone or what you wanted to get across was kind of there from the start.
At that time, I was working full-time as a postman. I was working in the sorting office at Islington on Upper Street and working nights. And I was surrounded by these kind of foul-mouthed kind of guys who were just kind of farting and telling jokes all night, and there was something kind of compelling and interesting about that voice. So Charlie Uncle Norfolk Tango is written in that kind of, I guess, white working class London kind of voice. It was originally commissioned as a short story for an anthology. By the time I got to the end of chapter one, I knew that this voice was going to take me a long way. So I forgot about the anthology and just concentrated on writing the novel. But I did actually write it at work. I just, would buy whatever kind of notebook or little Basil and Bond letter pads I could find and just go and disappear at work, find a quiet corner and just write it longhand, actually. Because the... Usually,
do you still write longhand?
Never. I never write longhand. I always, because actually the big benefit of working for the post office was that a necessary qualification for getting the job there was that you had to pass a typing exam. So they taught me to touch type, which has been a huge benefit to me as a writer. And normally I type straight away. But with Charlie Uncle Norfolk Tango, the it's written in a kind of phonetic representation of a kind of white working class voice, and I couldn't unlearn typing correctly in order to type it, and somehow the speed that I could write it longhand was the speed of this incredibly laborious intelligence that was the narrator of Charlie Uncle Norfolk Tango. So I was kind of writing at the speed he was thinking, in a way, which I couldn't have done If I were typing, Foxy T was another novel of voice. That was a novel that was written at the turn of the century, as that was typed. But as a result of that, I can't type the word ask now. It comes out axe, you know, AKS, because Foxy T was. I was wanting to write a novel about London, you know, about the bit of London that I was living in then, which was Whitechapel. This is in about 2000. And I wanted to sort of reject I mean, I love Ian Sinclair's work, but there was a kind of, maybe it was just a tendency in me sort of thinking about, but I was really getting bored of people just writing about Jack the Ripper and the Cray twins. It felt like that was the only thing that was going on in the East End, you know, if you believed what you were reading. It was, maybe this was around the time of sort of Guy Ritchie and Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels and things like that. And I was really bored of that. And I wanted to kind of write a novel that in this part of London that was, you know, where the stratification of cultures is visible, you know, a part of London that's created by migration. It seemed to me that rather than ignoring what was happening on the surface and looking for some East End Gothic bullshit, it was more interesting to map what was happening on the surface, you know, the kind of economies that were animating the, you know, Whitechapel now. And as luck would have it, the minicab company on Cannon Street Road closed down and there was a derelict building for a while. And I sort of projected my idea for a novel onto this building, and thought it would be also. I realized that no one had written a novel in an internet shop, and I was hoping that this would open up as an internet shop. It didn't, in fact, but one opened up next door or a couple of doors down, and this is in the days before broadband, you know, and here was this new kind of social space. And where people would go to communicate, but not with each other. It's an interesting thing. And funny enough, my first, the first short story I ever had published was a short story called A Pagan Day in an anthology called Techno Pagan that was published in 1995, edited by Elaine Palmer and published on Pulp Books. And that anthology was launched in the first internet cafe in the world, which was Siberia in London, which opened in 1994. You know, there was no such thing as an internet cafe before that. And when I was writing Foxy T, only 6 years later, internet cafes were ubiquitous around the world, you know, except the cafe bit had been forgotten. It was just an internet shop.
I wonder how long they'll survive for.
The other day, literally about two, I was back from Slovenia. I'm sure it was in this country. And I saw a sign saying internet cafe.
Yeah.
And I just thought that seems really archaic now.
In the transient area of every city in the world, there's an internet cafe.
Yeah, I suppose it's still, there is still a market.
Writing a novel sort of mapping economies, the most interesting economy just in terms of systems of exchange and meaning and value, the most interesting thing that was happening in the East End at that time was the emergence of what in 2008 would be called multicultural London English, you know, this new kind of new London English, which borrowed a lot from Black British, but also from other kind of other languages and grammars. And it seemed ridiculous to be writing about the East End of London in anything else but in multicultural London English. So Foxy T was also a kind of novel of voice, and it was just written in this what became known later as multicultural London English.
Did you run that by anyone who sort of speaks that as their mother tongue? That sounds almost sort of,
well, the thing was that. At that time it didn't belong to anybody at that time, multicultural London English, because it was just anybody was picking it up, you know.
Or putting it on.
Yeah. But if you speak it, you're speaking it, mm-hmm. you know. And it was the fact that there was a kind of rupture with the identity politics that had obtained for the previous kind of 40 or 50 years that was interesting about it, that you'd have young second generation men of, with parents from the Sylhet region of Bangladesh, who'd been brought up in Whitechapel, who'd be calling each other Rasta, you'd be on a bus and you'd hear someone speaking behind you, and no longer could you, if you wanted to, determine the ethnicity of the person by their voice. And that seemed to be that rupture was what was interesting about it. So I just kind of, I sort of wrote it really looking for the kind of grammar of multicultural London English.
Do you think that's something that's changed? I mean, since then, would you write a novel like Foxy T now, or do you?
I wouldn't, just because I suppose it was a kind of, it was trying to kind of map something that was emerging and kind of nascent, almost, before it became, established. So having done that, I'm not interested in writing Foxy T part two, though I have been asked. I suppose I'm still interested in that process of change and I don't know
what will be next.
What that will, how that will manifest in the streets around us in, a few years' time once I'm out of the current group of novels. So it's interesting.
Going back to your process in terms of the, you say you're nearing the end of writing the second book.
Yeah.
What happens then? Do you have a pause and then edit, or are you editing as you go along? Do you tend to sort of write a chapter and then look back over it and edit it, or do you wait until you've got a final draft of the entire piece?
I do little bits of editing as I'm going along, but really I need to know where it's going in order to know what
to edit.
what's working and what isn't, and what which are the important, I don't know necessarily which are the important bits, until I've got to the end. Mm. So, but there will be then a kind of, pass after pass, of editing for different aspects of things, the really straightforward stuff, like making sure that character X has the same name at the beginning of the novel as at the end of the novel, and just making sure timelines and things
so do you make right, quite so big structural changes ever in novels? Have you kind of gone back and gone, actually chapters 5, 6, and 7 I'm going to ditch them and changes around the last chapters are going to come the first chapter, changes like that. Does that happen?
Or? That does happen, but it's not going to happen with these because of the mandated vocabulary and the structure. Mm. So in a sense, there's a sort of editing in my head that's having to go on as I'm doing it in a way. But by the time it's ready to hand on to my agent, let's say, it will have gone through 100 edits or something. It'll be version 100 and something, or I might have gone past that and had to start again, a new numbering system. Mm. So it will have gone through, multiple edits before it leaves my desk.
Yeah. That's before anyone else sees it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then my agent, Patrick Walsh, will maybe have some comments, and edits that he thinks need doing before it leaves his desk. So there's that kind of rewrite. And then, the commissioning editor then kind of has their own, thoughts about any rewrites that are needed, which thankfully were minimal with Fountain in the Forest. But then, and then you go into the whole copy editing process, which is looking at it with a very fine tooth comb and realizing that you've used the word "although" 20 times on one page, you know. Yeah. But just nobody's noticed that yet.
And within your own editing process, do you have a place that you start and end? I mean, do you start chapter one, page one, and just work through?
Or? I do tend to do that. I sort of think of each, you know, I'm doing sort of edits at different kind of levels of resolution somehow. So they tend to be a sweep through the whole thing, looking for a particular particular change, or, you know, regulating a particular aspect of the structure. Or
do you read out loud when you're doing the editing?
I do sometimes. And actually, with some novels, reading them in public when they're drafts has been part of the process. Certainly with Charlie Uncle Norfolk Tango, that was something that I was reading live at live literature events probably a couple of years before it was published. Testing bits out on an audience to see what would work. And I do always have in mind the fact that that I will be reading bits of this novel out live. And I suppose reading to oneself, printing it out. There are all these kind of distancing techniques that you sort of learn, which are ways of alienating yourself from the text in order to see what's wrong with it, you know.
And how long does that, I mean, I guess it changes from novel to novel, but typically the, you know, 100 redrafts potentially, how much time does that take compared with writing the novel itself?
Might take a couple of months or...
And how long, sort of this work in progress, how long have you been working on that?
I've been working on this pretty much since the first wave of publicity for The Fountain in the Forest finished. So that's around June of last year. So about 18 months. I was very privileged to be given a residency. I had a residency in Croatia in the city of Split. Split has a residency program called the Marko Marulic residency program, which is for writers and translators from across Europe to, you know, it's designed to foster collaborations and sort of things like that. And after the first 6 months after The Fountain in the Forest came out, was pretty busy in terms of festivals and events and bookshop events and things like that. So it was fantastic to be able to just go away for a month and hole up in this little flat in Split and just start work on volume two, part two. So that's been 18 months so far. So it'll probably be around 2 years by the time it's, well, I'm hoping a little sooner than that actually, but yes, something like that.
With the editing process, using mandated vocabulary, so this probably would really only apply to Fountain in the Forest. Were there any edits that came back that would be suggesting taking lines or paragraphs out that involved a word you wanted to hold on to for obvious reasons that you then had to refit in?
Both my commissioning editor, who was Lee Brackstone at Faber, and the copy editor and the proofreader, they were all really switched on to the mandated vocabulary process, and so those bits weren't threatened in that way. There was a whole other kind of threat to them, which was that so actually the bits that got cut away were the sort of unnecessary stuff that was kind of unnecessary verbiage that was getting in the way of the economy of the mandated vocabulary. But the really strange thing was just how much language has changed, you know, in 30 odd years in terms of house styles and typographic conventions and things like that. And so the mandated vocabulary was almost every time somebody opened the manuscript, there was a risk that the hyphen in the word tea shop, which was common, you know, the common convention in 1985, would be taken out, just because no one's going to bother putting a hyphen in the word tea shop now. So there was, they had to be kind of protected against kind of reflex correction, you know, by everybody.
And were they in bold or?
So actually we ended up putting them in bold and highlighting them. And still that there was a tendency to correct, you know, so we had to sort of, build in these extra kind of proofing processes after anybody had seen it, you know, of just going through and making sure all of the mandated vocabulary was still intact. And in the end, we left it emboldened on the page in the finished book. Partly because I wanted that to function like sort of breadcrumbs on the forest floor or something, you know, and to disrupt the, you know, just a sort of, you know, I guess a kind of modernist disruption of the printed surface. But I think Lee Braxton, my editor at Faber on The Fountain in the Forest, realized that it would be a, maybe of interest to the reader, or it would give the reader another thing to hold on to, or another way into the story if they were kept bold. So, yeah.
And also, if they go back and try and do the crossword, they've got the answers now.
Yes, there is that. So somebody, I think that the critic Anna Aslanian, who's obviously more adept at crosswords than most people, suggested that all of those words be left blank in the whole of the next book in order that the reader had to do the crossword before they could read it. But I think that would be a bit asking a bit too much.
I don't know, I quite like that. I'm sure there is.
Well, I think we might do a special edition of one chapter or something somehow, just to maintain that.
I mean, it's the sort of the quick crossword, isn't it?
It is. And that's because that it's really going back to my own biography. That was the crossword that I did in the mid 80s. By about 1988, I'd kind of moved on to the cryptic crossword in the Guardian, which I did that for many years.
Because I think that would be cruel to have the cryptic crossword as the one with the blank words.
But yes,
I mean that's quite a high standard of crossword.
it is. Though once you've done, when you've done a few hundred of them, you get to know the compilers, and their particular kind of strategies and things. And in the quick crosswords, there's actually there are certain words that come up a lot, you know. So it's the reason that Detective Sergeant Rex King, for example, comes from Exeter, you know, he's born in Exeter, is that Exeter is a word that's used all the time in Guardian quick crosswords, or in crosswords generally, because it's so easy to cross, you know, it's got so many E's, you know.
Yeah, because I noticed there were words, sometimes quite sort of reasonably obscure words, that would come up a few times.
Yeah, so yeah.
I didn't know if that was a tick on the part of the crossword writer, but that makes good sense that, you can cross it.
But also, what's really interesting about looking at crosswords from another period of time is the kind of parade of historical figures that kind of appear in them. Some of whom may not even have reached their full kind of historical significance, like Jacques Chirac, you know, appears in 80s crosswords as a sort of former prime minister from the, you know, early 70s or whatever, long before he became the figure that we think of now, you know.
Yeah.
It does. I suppose it feels that it's, you know, by adhering to the kind of conventions of hyphenation and variant spellings of the mid 80s, there's a kind of seam of historical veracity or something that kind of that runs through the novels, but also a kind, you know, what I was saying earlier, the idea of this is somehow the kind of unconscious of the period, you know, it gives it a kind of grounding that it would be hard to find another way of writing a historical novel that's grounded in such diverse ways. You know, it's sort of
it's a sort of snapshot of the
and it's not exactly digressive, but it is a little bit digressive, maybe that is the word.
Well, I think we're just coming up towards near an hour.
So oh my gosh.
Thank you very much for coming in and speaking to us. I think you're going to be heading off shortly, you were saying.
I am. I'm going down to the South Bank to see the new Forced Entertainment performance, which is called Out of Order. Forced Entertainment, a very interesting experimental theatre company. They won the Ibsen Award for, you know, lifetime contribution to performance or something last year. It's like the Nobel Prize of theatre. But the director of Forced Entertainment is also an author called Tim Etchells, whose work I've published in the past, who has a new collection of short stories coming out called Endland in November. Mm-hmm. So it's also a chance to go and touch base with Tim, because we're doing a festival event up in Sheffield about that.
Okay.
Soon. So
that's in November, isn't it?
That's the festival event is in advance of publication, but so that's the 26th of October in Sheffield. Mm-hmm. And I think publication is 26th of November.
Okay, great. I had a question.
Yes.
It's a really, this is the sort of question at the end of readings or literary events.
Yes.
Someone will get up and ask a question like this, and we can edit this out. This doesn't have to be included in the podcast, because it winds me up. But I did a job where I had to learn the phonetic alphabet for it. And I was wondering, with Charlie, well, it's not Charlie Uniform November Tango, it's Charlie Uncle
Norfolk Tango.
Was there a reason for that decision?
There was. It was partly because the lifeboat lockers on a ferry from Essex to Ostend that I took in the early 90s to go and see the Vermeer exhibition in Den Haag were used Norfolk instead of November in their kind of alphabetical enumeration. And also because it scanned better. Mm-hmm. Charlie Uncle Norfolk Tango sounded better to me than Charlie Uniform November Tango.
Yeah.
Though there's a lot to be said for that as well. It has a symmetry to it at least. But yeah, Charlie Uncle Norfolk Tango was a just scanned better. And it said a lot in the novel. You know, when it comes over the police radio, Charlie Uncle Norfolk Tango, Charlie Uncle Norfolk Tango, this is Delta India Charlie Kebab, can you hear me? Over. it ties in with the kind of the whole stream of filth thing. Yeah.
Thank you to Tony White for joining us, and thank you for listening. If you'd like to find out anything more about Tony's writing, we'll put some information in the description of this episode, which you'll find below.
You can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com or on Twitter at lachlanbloom. You can find us as Unsound Methods at unsoundmethods.co.uk, and do like or subscribe wherever you find this podcast and tell your friends.
And if you'd like to find out about my writing, it's jamiebatchin.com, Twitter at jamiebatchin and Instagram at jamie_batchin. Thanks to everyone who graffitied a local landmark. Probably time to stop doing that. Thanks for listening.